Hey, man, it's fucking talking about vinegar syndrome stuff and etiquette pictures. I'm always fucking ready. You should have saved that crack for that for the show.
Something's coming.
Stand by. Hold on to your hats. Here we go.
Welcome, everyone, to the Screamcast, episode 80. I am Sean DeRigger, and with me, as always...
80?
Yeah, man. Brad Henderson.
Seems like we've been on 80 for, like, ever.
We just got there. We were on 79 last week.
I guess.
I only know it's mile. Mess it up.
It's a mile fucking stone right here. I guess. Fucking 80 episodes.
BJ is stuck in some dress rehearsal shit, so she may not make it on. We'll see. I extended the invitation. If she feels up to it when she's done, she may join us. If not, she won't. But we do have, I'm told to introduce him as The Q. I don't know. For birth, movies, death. What's up, man? He goes by Jacob Q Knight on Twitter.
Hello. Don't call me The Q.
I was about to say. We got to cut that shit short soon.
Well, you know. I was going to call him Jacob.
Jacob.
Yeah, that works, too.
Okay. You never know who anyone is on Twitter. Everybody. You never know.
It's true.
So you guys were hanging out at Fantastic Fest together, right?
If you want to call hanging out. I mean, well, something was hanging out.
Wow.
That didn't happen.
How involved is Birth Movies Death, Death at Fantastic Fest? Do you guys get involved with a lot of stuff? Are you there just as press? Because I know you guys were created through the Draft House or by the Draft House, or what's the story with that? Because I just knew you guys as Badass Digest, and that was it. I'm not in the know.
Yeah, well, they... Devin started the site when Tim League, creator of the Draft House, basically wanted a film website to kind of go along with the business. And that's when, Badass Digest started. And he brought on a bunch of, writers kind of over the years. And then it changed to Birth Movies Death, because in the Draft House there's the print version of the magazine, and it was kind of a more of like a brand synergy, if you will, to where just everything kind of syncs up now to where you have Birth Movies Death online, you have Birth Movies Death in the theaters,
okay,
and we also have hats now, which is really weird. Because they're selling hats with Birth Movies Death on them in the Draft House, and I saw people wearing them at Fantastic Fest, and I was like, "That's that's kind of weird."
Yeah, that's weird.
Nice. Okay, because I was wondering because I was fond of the name Badass Digest because that's all I ever knew it as, and then when it changed, I was like, "What the fuck are they doing?" And but then I did find out about the design and stuff, so that's cool.
Yeah, you and everybody else was kind of thrown by it. But, I mean, I really like the new name. Yeah. It was weird to tell people that you wrote for Badass Digest. Not that I didn't like that name, too, but that was cool. But, I mean, Birth Movies Death, it's a little easier to call mom and be like, hey, I write for Birth Movies Death instead of Badass Digest. She's like, all right.
Right, okay. That works. So apparently a lot of people are getting disapproving looks from their mothers.
For Badass Digest?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Anyway, all right. Well, today... excuse me.
Today whoa, you sick? Are you getting cold?
No, I'm fine. I'm fine.
No, you are? Okay.
We're finally going to be getting back to the video, oh my God, segment. And
that is really awful.
Stream squeeze. Jesus Christ.
Basically, we took a hiatus from our segments, and they're back today. I just need you to relax.
Jesus Christ.
Segments are back, and they're back with a bang.
I hope
bang,
so.
Bang, bang.
I hope so. We are going to be talking about some etiquette pictures stuff, as well as some Vinegar Syndrome release, kind of changing up a little bit, talking some non-horror when everyone else is talking horror. So we're going to change it up a tiny bit. But first, we got to jump into what's on our doorstep.
Holy cow, I almost forgot.
We'll get the door.
Pizza.
Jacob, do you have any What's on Your Doorstep movies?
I do.
All right, let's hear it.
Now, am I allowed to talk about stuff that I saw in the theater, too, or is it just specifically what
Dude,
showed up?
Fucking talk about whatever the fuck you want. We don't even care. We're open to movies.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess the number one thing I absolutely loved is when I actually ordered Some Call It Loving and American Dreamer. I also threw on like one of Vinegar Syndrome's, you know, like $10 double feature discs, and I got Sweet Trash.
Ooh,
which oh yes,
is so good. It's on a disc with The Hang Up, I believe it is. I haven't watched that one yet, but I just watched Sweet Trash last night, and I'm at a loss. Like I was trying to tell somebody today, like what it even is, and I'm not even sure that I'm good at describing what the film actually is. It almost plays as like this perverted crime thriller that's like 79 minutes long, and it's so garishly colored, like it's all bright. Like that opening hotel room that we kind of crawl through has that bright red carpet. Like everything just kind of jumps out at you. It's really.
Yeah,
really quite something. But it's a crime movie about a longshoreman and a loan shark. And the loan shark basically, you know, the longshoreman gets in for like $6,000 in a card game to the loan shark. And then the individuals that the loan shark works for are like these shady – are they government officials? They never actually explain it, but take orders.
Yeah, they don't really say it.
Yeah, they take orders from a computer who like says like they have to kill certain people if they, you know, rack up enough amount of debt. And so the longshoreman goes on this crazy like psychedelic journey where he's on the run. It's almost like watching somebody's nightmares. Like it's almost like the worst stress anxiety dream put to film. But almost if like it was written by Arthur Miller while he was doing blow in like a Denny's bathroom in 1969. Like you're just watching this guy mentally collapse and run around and talk to like Puerto Rican prostitutes. And at one point he jumps, like does a skydive through like a church window on a 20th floor of like this warehouse. But the whole time these weirdo hitmen are on his tail. And there's also they never really tied narratively the crime boss slash figure who's like – he comes off as almost flamboyantly gay with the way he's dressed. He has these crazy flower scarves and this wild lisp. But then he just is surrounded by naked women the whole time. So the whole movie is just a clash of insane aesthetics that – drive you wild and you kind of just fall into. And it's only 79 minutes long. By the time like you think it can't get any nuttier, it just ends and just leaves it there for you.
Perfect.
Are you familiar with any John Hayes other work? Because Vinegar Syndrome has actually released a lot of his movies he's directed and written.
You know, I'm not. And this actually goes back to even before like you guys asked me to be on the podcast and stuff and do like the Etiquette Pictures and Vinegar Syndrome stuff, which I'm a huge fan of anything Vinegar Syndrome does. So I'm really excited to dig into the rest of this dude's work. But at Fantastic Fest, I was talking to – do you know Matt Lynch from Scarecrow Video?
Yeah. And,
like we were just hanging out outside before, whatever we were seeing next. And I love Matt Lynch. Like he's as like a trash cinema guy. Like I don't think there's a whole lot more on this planet that are more knowledgeable than he is. So we can just, I'd love just hearing him rattle on for hours about this stuff. And he really went on about John Hayes and Sweet Trash and about how great it was and how basically outlandish it is. And now I want to watch all of this guy's movies, because if he dreamed this nonsense up, God only knows what else it is.
Nice. It is available if you've signed up for Exploitation TV. It is available streaming there.
Yeah.
I think some of his, because he's, they've released, I think, Dream No Evil, The Cutthroats, The Hang Up, Sweet Trash. I want to say Hot Lunch they've done as well.
There's a vampire movie he did too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Grave of the Vampire is fucking great.
Yeah, there we go. That's the next one. I want to watch The Hang Up, and then I want to watch Grave of the Vampire. Then I might just keep going, because it gives me an excuse to keep watching whatever Vinegar Syndrome puts out.
Yeah, awesome. No, he's done all his movies are very batshit, and they're just very quick too. They don't last very long. They're like an hour and 10 minutes. And,
which is great.
Yeah. No, I mean, because that much insanity sometimes, because the films that I've seen from him are very comparable to Sweet Trash.
Okay.
So,
become my favorite director ever by the time I'm done.
Yeah, he's definitely one of a kind. I will say that. So, yeah, definitely pick up Sweet Trash.
He almost seems to come at least from the same school of DIY kind of outsider art filmmaking as guys who obviously he had more of a career than these dudes. But when I watch stuff like by like Craig Denny, who did The Astrologer, obviously, or like Duke Mitchell's stuff, if we saw Dangerous Men just at Fantastic Fest, like that really outlandish stuff that still gives you this singular vision of the world that could have only come from, it only comes from this weirdo at very minimal resources, but kind of a vision that...
Well, they're making the movies that they want to see, too, you know?
Yeah.
That's how it feels.
Yeah, no, totally. And it's
so, and that's when you have movies like that, it's more, you can feel the passion behind it. No matter if it's how bad it is, how goofy, there's a certain aesthetic to it to where you can, I don't know, kind of attach yourself, especially if you've ever wanted to make a movie or wrote a film. I think you can show more of appreciation, more for a love when you know that someone put their heart and soul into something like you said, Dangerous Men. I mean, how long did that guy work on that movie? He said like fucking 20 years.
Yeah, it was insane. Well, it was like 1989 to like 2005, was it?
Yeah, until like basically he died or whatever. Like, he died like in 2010. But I mean, from making the music to editing all that within 20 years, like that's a huge accomplishment. Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's some type of failure, but that failure is turned out to be success in every aspect of a film lover's world, because I mean you finally got, I mean, I guess Hollywood would call that a failure, but to us that's an achievement. I mean, he never gave up and he created something that's super unique and very memorable, and it's just not a throwaway movie like Hollywood blockbusters are, where they're totally forgettable after you watch them. Watch Dangerous Men once and you can kind of remember the whole thing, and you could talk to your friends, you know, months and months after it. You know, you don't have to watch it again to recollect what happened or, you know, what to do. It's one of those movies that just stick with you. And I guess, yeah, very comparable to, you know, John Hayes' films as well.
Yeah. I mean, and also with Dangerous Men, very few movies have a scene where a girl pulls a knife out of her butt cheeks to stab her. Which is one of the stranger things I've ever seen in a movie theater.
Or when just a movie just fucking ends, like, right in the middle of the scene.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Holy shit. But anyways, that's great, yeah.
But I guess that's been the main thing that's been on my doorstep that I watched that I totally kind of went nuts for. I would say that if I had another pick, I would talk about something I saw in the theater, which is, have you guys seen... Now, I always wonder if I'm butchering the name, but is it Sicario?
I guess it's Sicario. I was saying Cicero for some reason. I have no idea.
Sicario is how I would say
it. Sicario,
but then it has the Roman translation in the beginning, and it had me thinking Italian to where I was saying something in my head very similar, like Cesario.
Yeah, who knows?
Sicario might be. I don't know if it's the best movie I've seen or best American film I've seen this year, but it's very, very close. Have you guys seen it yet?
No, I
have not. And it's funny because my boss came to me today and was like, dude, you need to watch Sicario. He's like, have you seen it yet? And he likes movies, but he was just going off about this movie. So
yeah, it's weird how it's very accessible for even that guy's movies, because I mean, obviously it's Denis, Villeneuve, who did Prisoners, he did Enemy, and like Prisoners, it was accessible. It obviously was like a mainstream film, but it was also like a 2.5 hour crime procedural slash, like, almost, not to give away some of the stuff in the ending, but like a satanic horror film in a way, or played on that satanic panic from like the 80s and kind of traded in that iconography a little bit. But Enemy is a total like art picture, despite even having Jake Gyllenhaal in it. It's a very strange, cold Cronenbergian movie that is really, really good. But it's one that, like, you know, kind of like you just said, Sean, like if you have a buddy at work or like a boss at work or whatever, who's like kind of like halfway into movies or is like just kind of likes mainly like mainstream stuff, like I would have trouble being like, oh yeah, you should totally watch Enemy.
Yeah.
This movie is incredible because it's lean. It's 2 hours almost on the dot. I think it's like 2 hours and 4 minutes. And it works as a hybrid of like this almost Michael Mann or William Friedkin style amoral procedural about these FBI agents who basically get called into this government task force to go down to Juarez, Mexico. And essentially, without saying it, but they basically allude the entire time that nobody's ever going to get arrested here. This is an assassination coup almost, or an assassination plot hatched by our own CIA to basically take out this cartel head, or at least like flush him out. But it works as half of that level. It gets very meticulous and it's procedural, a lot like how Michael Mann like loves to kind of fixate on details of how cops basically get from point A to point B, and with like those kind of levels of deduction and investigation. But then also it works as kind of this kick-ass revenge thriller with Emily Blunt's character, to where she is, you know, because she's initially roped in because of an explosion while she is investigating basically this almost like stash house for a cartel member across the border. And it takes out, you know, a bunch of her men in this team. So she gets recruited on with the sole intention of let's go after these guys and avenge ourselves. And by the end, it almost turns into like a Lovecraftian horror film. And it's about descending into these dark depths of like humanity and really seeing how awful human beings can be in the name of profiteering and really just being cruel to one another. And it's a real hell of a movie. I was super impressed with it.
Nice. Yeah, I can't wait to watch it. I wanted to see it. There was a weekend I had a Friday night free, and I wanted to see it then, but it was limited. But then the next weekend, when it opened wide. Did it open wide this last weekend or the weekend before?
I think it was the last weekend of Fantastic Fest, because it was the first movie I saw in the theater after Fantastic Fest.
Yeah, and I haven't been able to make it out to the theater since. But it's on my radar. If I ever get a free night, I'm going to go check it out. But I'll be probably just blind buying this Blu-ray when it comes out.
it's worth it. Well, the other thing that's great to watch for too, if I can try and urge you, obviously I know you got responsibilities and stuff you got to attend to, But if I could urge you to sneak away and get out the door, man, that Roger Deakins cinematography, the big screen, is wonderful. Because he balances almost like a Zero Dark 30 feel with watching these like tactical squads kind of descend on these kind of cartel bases and into these cartel tunnels. But also mixes it with almost like the stuff that he was doing in Assassination of Jesse James, where he lingers on like curtains flapping in the wind or like after a shootout. And it's those moments that happen basically in between the bullets that are like the real kind of cinema happening for you. And it's really wonderful.
Nice. Yeah. I'll have to make it happen for sure. Hey, it's my birthday this week. So,
happy birthday.
We're going to make it happen.
Yeah.
Make it happen. My birthday movie. I always go out and see one movie on my birthday.
Wow.
I do the same thing.
What was it last year?
I forget what last year was. I saw Sinister shit on my birthday. That was 2 years back.
Lord of the Rings. What should be Lord of the Rings?
No, and I saw
it's gonna be Lord of the Rings.
Oh, shut up. No, Drive on my birthday once. So I always go, you know, the more upscale things.
It's a very uneventful conversation that just happened. I was expecting more.
I used to take, like, a bunch of friends to movies, and they would always get mad at me because it wasn't, like, anything really mainstream. It'd be something like Punch Drunk Love or Confessions of a
Teenage Drama Queen?
No, someone with Sam Rockwell and George Clooney.
Confessions of a Dangerous Mind.
Yes.
I was just giving you shit.
And I would always get shit from people who didn't like the movies I was choosing.
But, like Freaky Friday?
No, I didn't go to Freaky Friday.
I did.
Anyway, enough about me. Is there anything else, Jacob?
No, I think everything else I kind of watched was the stuff we're going to talk about anyway.
Okay.
So I would pass it on to whoever's next.
I'll go next.
Oh, good.
I mean, other than the stuff that we're going to be talking about, the only thing that I want to mention was I finally watched Insidious 2 and Insidious 3. I've had Insidious 2 since the Blu-ray came out, sitting on my shelf. I've never watched it. And,
like everything else.
Insidious...
You probably could have been better not watching it.
I'm a huge fan of the first one. I love Insidious, and I'd heard mixed things about Insidious 2. So I think that's kind of why it kept me from grabbing it. But Insidious 3 came out, so it was I grabbed it. And I decided to finally watch two. So I watched two, and I dug it. I had a lot of fun with it. It's definitely not as fun as the first one. I mean, that red-faced demon or whatever is just fantastic. Like, there's nothing that comes close in Insidious 2. But they kind of build the mythology a little more. I feel like the story and everything kind of crumbles a bit under this just more and more mythology kind of getting piled on. But overall, I thought it was fun, and then once it ended, I was like, and with every movie, the first one had like a cliffhanger, and this one kind of has you think everything's fine, and then of course a cliffhanger, and then I was like, well shit, I gotta jump into Insidious 3, and then I remembered, oh shit, it's a prequel, so...
prequel!
Yeah, so I wasn't gonna get the satisfaction of finding out what the hell happened, you know, next in the story of everyone. Keep any spoilers down, I guess, if you're like me and hadn't seen Insidious 2. So then I was all amped, so I popped in Insidious 3, and I dug that for what it was. I feel like they were trying a little too hard with the jump scares this time around. Like, almost, it was amped to 11 with the music and everything.
11.
But, 11. But overall, like, I think this is a strong series. Like, you know, a lot of horror movies is kind of diminishing returns once we get to 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 or whatever. This one, though, like, this series, I think, it's staying in line with all the mythology it's building. I think it works. It's kind of having fun with it. Like, with Insidious 2, there's a kind of a time travel-esque element where things that happened in the first movie, you find out what caused those things, and they're, you know, different from what you assumed, I guess, after seeing the first film. So overall, like, I think it's a for me, it's a it's one of the stronger kind of, you know, haunted type movies. You know, I would definitely check out Insidious 4 rather than another freaking Paranormal Activity movie.
How do you know though? What if it's a found footage Paranormal Activity crossover? Come on, Sean.
If they do a Insidious / Paranormal crossover, Paranormal Activity crossover, I think I'm done. Isn't the new Paranormal Activity supposed to be in 3D?
I don't know.
I call bullshit.
Yeah, anyway.
I think Insidious.
Jacob's trying to talk over here.
What? What's up?
Who Jacob's directed the third one? Because that's not James Wan, right?
Lee Whannell, the writer.
The writer. He handed James Wan kind of turned it over to
Lee
Whannell.
Lee Whannell. Yeah.
Okay. What do you guys think of James Wan's stuff in general? Because I think this is where my disconnect with the Insidious films comes from. I don't like him as a director at all.
I think he's okay. I don't think he has a style. You know what I mean? I don't think he has I don't feel like he has his own kind of voice as a filmmaker, if that makes any sense.
Well, he kind of carries.
I think that's wrong.
No? I mean, Fast and Furious 7 looks just like Fast and Furious whatever. Fast and Furious 8 or whatever the hell we're at now.
That's also a big studio film that he just probably took to gain a little bit more in his career.
Yeah, there are certain little flourishes, and that's where I think Insidious, the first one, is more of a James Wan film than the others. Because of that red-faced demon, like he's, and what's that puppet movie that he did?
Dead Silence.
Like there's those flourishes with that kind of, you know, the puppets and that kind of design aspect, I guess. But, you know, once it gets to Insidious 2, I don't see a fingerprint of a filmmaker. You know, I don't see his fingerprint as much.
Well, the puppets, that's all his, like, Argento fetish. Yeah. Like, because he loved Saw. I mean, in Saw, like, he even admitted that, like, the puppet in Saw was directly lifted from Deep Red, correct? And then, I mean, I think there's some defined style there. I just don't like what he does because he does that whole industrial funhouse thing that I can't really get into, like all the quick cutting in Saw. Some of that carries over to Dead Silence. It's a little more steadily made. But then, like, Death Sentence – all just industrial grunt. Now, I kind of like Death Sentence because it's grimy and gross.
Yeah.
But it has that same kind of weird urban, very metallic feel almost. And then he started making almost classically minded ghost pictures with like Insidious and The Conjuring. Like he's because Insidious is very much a poltergeist riff.
Oh yeah.
Like it's him doing his poltergeist. And then The Conjuring is like a throwback to kind of those 70s ghost stories. Almost, I don't want to say burnt offerings, but like stuff that's way more in line with, you know, something like The Omen.
That's where I say like, I don't feel like I see his fingerprints anymore. Like once you move past his early films,
I think he wants to emulate his passion and his movies that he loves with each individual movie he makes. Cause I mean, like Jacob was saying, like with Saw, I mean, Saw, Dead Silence, Death Sentence, Insidious, and The Conjuring are all totally different movies.
Yeah.
Like from a filmmaking aspect, I mean, like Death Sentence feels like his like love for Vigilante or something like that. It feels like you know, a new age like Bill Lustig film to me. Dead Silence feels like a throwback to old, you know, Italian ghost stories, especially just how the film shot in general. I think Saw is more kind of less just kind of getting his foot in the door and trying to see like how far he could go. But I mean, like Insidious, like definitely a callback to kind of the family horror films that existed, you know, everything from Poltergeist to The Gate. And of course, The Conjuring is a huge throwback to all the 70s haunted house movies. I don't think Furious 7, I don't think we can actually count that number one, because he took that obviously because that's a huge endeavor. And he wanted to accomplish something more than horror films.
Right.
And also, that movie just was fucked from ever since Paul Walker's death. So I don't know if he could actually full force put his fingerprint, so-called, yeah, on that, just because that movie was kind of fucked ever since then.
Well, those movies are so big, and they're kind of a machine.
It's
their own machine. So.
But I honestly think it would have been different if Paul Walker never died.
Yeah.
By far.
Movies like the Fast movies are all second unit movies, though, too. Half of those are shot, you know, by second unit crews doing action set pieces and then found in, you know, the editing room. So, I mean, it's tougher, I guess, to fault James Wan for not having his own, I guess, auteurist fingerprint on something like Fast 7. Because, I mean, the guy before him that ended up directing for True Detective, Justin Lin, he doesn't really have a fingerprint, let's
say. All those films feel the same.
Yeah, and they're meant to. It's a franchise.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you had a completely different vision with something, you might throw off your audience because that's not what they're used to. But I think for his horror films and Death Sentence, because, I mean, Death Sentence is a horror film in general to begin with, but I think all those films, he wants to pull what he loves, so therefore he's not giving, like you said, that auteur status to where it's like, oh, this is a James Wan film. I don't necessarily think he wants that, other than maybe connecting, which he was putting, you know, Billy the Doll somewhere in the films to start. But I think other than that, I don't think he wants the movies to be relatable, other than if it's a sequel, you know, like Insidious and Insidious 2.
Yeah, no, I'm fine with him as a director, though. I mean, he's one of those directors I like hearing him interviewed about his films. I like hearing him talk about his filmmaking process and everything. And it's just, you know, I'm definitely would check out anything he does. You know, I'm excited to see The Conjuring 2. I know that they're filming that, and then is he really attached to Aquaman?
Yeah.
Holy shit! Wow. A little less excited about that, but, you know, but good for him, you know.
Death Sentence is a direct adaptation of a Brian Garfield novel too, right? Because, like, Brian Garfield wrote Death Wish, and then Death Sentence was, like, the follow-up to Death Wish. But, you know, obviously Canon Films made Death Wish into what the Death Wish series became.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which was fucking nuts.
Great. It was great. I mean, it probably could have used less rape, but it's still pretty great.
No, I mean, I think Brian Garfield definitely had, I mean, everything from, you know, like Death Wish to even, you know, just his stepfather. There is this really gritty, I don't know, man, it's just, it's a very unique style. I mean, because you take Death Wish, Death Sentence, and Stepfather, I don't know, they kind of seem from the same, they definitely seem from the same world.
Right.
So, but I think that's the charm of James Wan. I don't know. It seems that it's cool to have, you know, a vision to where you can watch a movie and say, you know, that's a George Romero film, that's a Carpenter film, you know, that's a Tarantino film. But I also think it's really cool of when you don't have that, you know, where you can't relate your films. Yeah. I think both are very cool because, one, it seems that the reason why people could tell your movies together is because, like, Wes Anderson. Yeah, I love Wes Anderson, but when you turn it on, you know what the fuck you're watching. You know when you're watching a John Waters movie, which is cool, but at the same time, I think it's super cool when you don't have that. I don't know. That's just me, though.
No, that's cool. I agree. I mean, as long and if they're really good movies, you know, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, if he's serving the script and the story, that's really all that matters. You know, so. Yeah,
I mean, fine. I don't think James Wan's a, you know, fucking revolutionary, but yeah. I think he's making some pretty kick-ass movies.
He's no Eli Roth. That he's been, you know what I'm saying, guys?
You need to calm down. So I'm just hoping that he does his word and fucking does this Mortal Kombat thing he's taking on. So, Because I want to see another goofy fucking Mortal Kombat movie is what I want.
Totally.
I don't ever want to watch any of those movies.
finally, we got off track here.
Just to go back to Insidious, because I've always... just real quick, this is my input on Insidious, and this is the reason why I like it so much. Because when the first one came out, it kind of got half and half. I guess more hate than love. But look at it as if the ghosts and goblins and demons and everything from the further are never, ever there for the boy. Right. They're using him as bait in order to get Josh to remember everything, to become possessed. That's all they're there for. And if you look at the movie from that aspect, it kind of makes a lot more sense than it does. Because there is these batshit crazy things where fucking he doesn't go home when his family's being terrorized. Mm-hmm. You know, but if you look at it, the aspect of like, he was made to forget, so by all means, he does not believe that there is fucking ghosts at his house. It'd be like if your wife called you and said, hey, there's a huge giant monster in our driveway. The first thing you're going to do is be like, no, you're fucking stupid. That's not true. But he's made to believe, like, he's, you know, hypnotized and you know, made to forget all those memories. So if you look at it more as like a ransom, like they're kidnapping him in order for him to remember, the movie's a lot more fun. Mm-hmm. The first and second one, and I think even though they don't say it in the second one, that's kind of what they allude to even more, is that they're basically kidnapping the kid in order for him to remember.
Yeah.
Because that's ultimately how they're going to win. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think they're solid. I think one and two were great together. And I was wondering when I finished watching the first one, I was like, man, how are they going to make a second one? How are they going to top that? Because it goes from haunted house flick with some really great scares to just...
We're jumping back into Insidious talk. I just wanted to say that, Sean.
To just batshit craziness with the further stuff. And the more batshit it got, the more I love these flicks. So, anyway, I want there to be an Insidious 4.
No.
And I want to figure out what happened at the end of 2.
The fucking...
That needs to be explained.
Fireface Man's back. Go ahead. Next.
I don't want to talk too much about it because I think we're going to be having some of the guys involved with it on. But Deathgasm is on VOD. Rent that shit or buy that shit. It's only like $9.99 to buy it and watch it. It's awesome. We'll get into it more later, I think.
Deathgasm.
But it's great. It was like everything I kind of wanted and was expecting and more.
Yeah, I mean, it's a heavy metal horror film with fucking demons and metal. I mean, yeah. It's perfect.
Yep.
If you want that sort of thing.
It was exactly what I wanted at the time I watched it. So.
Good for you, Sean. Good for you.
That was it. Brad, what you got?
Nothing. Let's move on to Etiquette Picture. No, I literally don't have anything.
Nice. Okay.
I've been busy and sick, so.
Yep. I do need to say you and Josh Obershaw have been submitting stuff on the site, and I got to say, you know, I think it's really been adding a lot to the website over at
thespoilcast.com. I had a lot of people contact me about the Exploitation Starter Kit.
Nice.
So I was very, very happy with that. The heavy metal horror thing posted today, which I like heavy metal horror. So if you like Deathgasm, check out the heavy metal horror list because there's a bunch of doozies in there.
Yep, it's going great. I think tomorrow we'll post another thing from Josh Obershaw. So I'm excited about that, and I gave him an assignment. So you know, the more content on our site, the better. And I'm very happy with what's been posted. So everyone, check it out. I haven't contributed worth shit.
Yeah.
So someday I'll write something.
It's like usual.
But head over to thescreamcast.com and check those out. That's all I got to say about that. Moving along, yes, we're... it's kind of... When you mentioned that we should talk about some of these Etiquette Pictures movies, I figured, you know, oh, wait, we're in October and everyone's covering horror movies, so why would we do that? But I think it's almost the perfect time, to cover these because everyone's watching horror movies. Everyone's into the October thing. Every now and then I need a little break from the horror movies. So this was fun to kind of jump into and talk about them. But, before we jump into the two etiquette pictures, flicks, let's talk briefly, about Crypt of the Living Dead. Now, this was released with, as House of the Living Dead, another
film? Yeah, House of the Living Dead. This is the first, this is well, not joint. I mean, it's still Vinegar Syndrome. This is their first exploitation TV release.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, too. Are they, because I noticed another one, which movie is this? Nightmare Weekend has the exploitation TV. Are they doing that only for certain titles?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how they're picking them. I mean, obviously they're porno. I think it's to get. I think the Vinegar Syndrome label is going to be more geared to sexploitation, hardcore stuff. Etiquette Pictures is going to be kind of more maybe artsy fartsy, the blaxploitation films, and then exploitation TV is going to be more or less their like horror and stuff like that. That's kind of vibe I'm getting, and that's how it's playing out so far. So I might be right. But it's up to them. I mean, they can do whatever the fuck they want. Just as long as the movies are released. I don't give a shit what label they're on. Hannah, Queen of the Vampires, a.k.a. Crypt Living Dead. Great scan.
Yeah,
it looks good.
It looks amazing.
It looks really good. It's surprising. But that's what I really love about Vinegar Syndrome is they really just to me, unless there's a hardcore fan of Crypt of the Living Dead, please contact me and let me know what you actually liked about the movie. But I don't know, it's just I have mad respect when I watch things like this is because who the fuck would release this maybe other than Code Red or Vinegar Syndrome? You know, and it's just they really take the time in a fucking 2K transfer of, you know, the 35mm negative to this movie that's not, it has moments, but ultimately is kind of boring for the most part.
Yeah. A lot of wandering around.
Jacob,
and just talk.
Jacob, what'd you think?
It's not good. It's not very good, but I kind of see if you were a hardcore Euro horror kind of aficionado, how that might fit into something that you like. Like if you like things like the just kind of Jess Franco's less pervier transmissions, let's say, or
which is exactly why I probably don't like it.
Yeah, no, it's definitely sexploitation without the sex. You know, it hints at being almost like a low rent, pervy, you know, sub Hammer movie, but really just kind of feels like a Turkish version of a Jess Franco film because it's a Spanish movie, but it was shot in Turkey. And it has this really ruddy, rundown feel to it. It meanders for a good portion of, but I mean, at least it's only like, what, 80 minutes or whatever?
Yeah, it's very short.
But I mean, there's just not a whole lot there. I couldn't even, again, tell you what it's truly about other than, like, a guy's – is it his father dies?
Yeah.
And he returns to an island where, like, this
– they come across a burial ground with vampires.
A vampire.
Yeah. A vampire, sorry. And
she's able to, like, psychically hypnotize people into doing whatever she wants.
And it's usually really boring stuff.
Yeah, and she turns into a wolf.
She doesn't make them do anything cool.
Yeah, and yeah, it's the
there's like a love triangle there or something with the brother and the sister and then the guy. Some stuff like that.
It's just that they really I don't know, it honestly feels like there is probably like being that this was made in Turkey, maybe some definitely just kind of lost in translation as well. That's kind of what it feels like. So I don't know. It's just really tough because it feels like there wants to be something there. It's just that we don't ever get that at all. What is happening? What is that noise? Are you unwrapping something?
It was a bread bag.
Oh. Just eating bread.
Are you eating Doritos or?
No.
I was getting hungry.
Are you going to tell us what it is at least?
Sorry, I was walking.
I was walking away while we're talking. This is exactly how interesting Crypt the Living Dead
exactly.
is that the guest gets up and walks away. So, I mean, it's I appreciate that Vinegar Syndrome obviously took the time to restore this and everything. This is my second time watching it, unfortunately. But like I was telling Jacob at some point, like, this is something that I watched when I was really young. And, you know, it's like, you know, when you're young, you just base everything off of, you know, cover art or titles. Mm-hmm. So you're like, you know, Crypt the Living Dead. Yeah, it's going to be fucking zombies everywhere. And there's no zombies. There's hardly any horror. And like 15 minutes into it, I was probably masturbating to something, you know. So I totally fucking forgot about it. It's the same thing. Like, this movie's good. It's another Vinegar Syndrome title. Hopefully they released it on Blu-ray. But I remember like picking up the, you know, the box to I Dismember Mama. And I'm like, man, they're going to be like chopping her up and stuff and making her eat in her own like fucking arms. No. It's nothing like that. But, you know, it's just a sort of you appreciate this type of work. And then we also have House Living Dead. Did you guys check that out?
I didn't. After this, I was like, I don't know. Is it better?
No. No. It's but let's just say it's a perfect double feature.
Is House of the Living Dead as restored as Crypt of the Living Dead, or
yeah. Well, I mean, it's definitely a little bit more messed up. That's the reason why. I mean, but like the print, the negative isn't that in very good condition. Let's just put it that way. So, but this was Curse of the Dead. I think like Diamond Video Releasing or whatever released this back in the day. It's more entertaining because a lot of crazier things happen. Like, Crypt of the Living Dead there's just a lot of drawn out things. You know, one thing I noticed is that whenever, what's the fucking guy's name? Andrew Pine, whatever his name is. I don't know his name in the movie. But he's like, he goes into the crypt and then he's like writing on his little clipboard of the tools he needs. But it's like 3 minutes of him discussing what he needs to hoist this, you know, cemetery, you know, fucking tombstone off the ground. Talks about attaching the pulley to the top of the ceiling, and then it goes showing them doing it without any dialogue at all. And it's like you're watching like a Home Improvement channel for a second.
His name is Chris Bolton.
Ugh, Chris Bolton, whatever. So, you know, in that sense, it really drags and is really boring. At least with House Living Dead, it's a little bit more batshit and a little bit more entertaining, but it is really dumb.
Okay.
So, but anyways.
Yeah. It's a shame, because I mean, there's a great poster of, like, this half-woman, half-wolf coming out of a crypt, you know, The poster is really great, and I was really hoping for at least some batshit crazy goofiness.
No,
and it doesn't really happen at all. Like, the opening's really great with like when the guy, it must be this guy's father, right? He's checking out the crypt or whatever, and like, you know, like the set is really cool, like wherever they're at. You know, I was like, oh, here we go. The kind of
beautiful set
feels
too,
like a Hammer horror type thing, you know. But it definitely does not anywhere close to any sort of Hammer horror.
No, I think that's a good explanation. It's like Hammer and Jess Franco got together.
Yeah.
And then they both were fired. And then the script burned to smithereens, and then they just decided to keep filming the movie.
They stretched out like the first 10 pages into like a feature length.
Ugh, but anyways, if you want to watch it, it's on Exploitation TV, and Blu-ray is probably pretty cheap if you like that Euro trash stuff. So
there you go.
Anyways.
Moving along into the etiquette picture stuff.
James B. Harris.
Oh, gosh. Now, I wasn't. We're going to be talking some.
Oh God, here we go.
And
you just want me to start talking since you didn't watch it?
You know, I'm covering my bases here. I'm not going to pretend that I freaking watched it. But I wanted to watch it. It was on my agenda to watch over the weekend, and I had sat down to watch this, and it was just me and my 3-year-old hanging out, and he's playing with the trains.
It's a great movie to watch with a kid.
Well, he's playing with his trains over in the corner. I'm sitting there at the computer watching the flick.
Well, Solomon and King's running the train.
Right. Well, anyway, I look up, and he has his pants down with diarrhea just running down his legs. So I had to deal with that, clean the carpets, and then my wife came home and with the other kids, and I was not able to finish this film. But I really loved what I saw the first 10 minutes and what I read about. And, Brad, I'm really interested in hearing what you think about Some Call It Loving, because I really want to finish this film.
Wait, before we go any further, Sean, did you see your son shit on the floor?
He pulled out his pull-up, I guess, as he was shitting or something, and had more, I don't know. He basically, what he did was, but the doctor said my son needs a little more, my middle child needs some more fiber, so I bought these fiber wafers.
Oh my God, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Jesus Christ.
My daughter
fiber left, to a little child. They shit everywhere.
My daughter left the fiber wafers within reach of the 3-year-old. She was looking at it or something, and he grabbed it and he thought it was candy. This was last.
That's
night.
A Kirby Enthusiasm show. It's an episode,
and thus he had explosive diarrhea all over the floor.
Yes, all day long. It's been an ongoing thing, but I think he's better now. So.
That's amazing.
Dear baby Jesus.
So, all right. Wow.
I bet your house smells amazing.
I have some pretty good carpet cleaner stuff. Luckily, most of it got into the pull-up and his pajama pants that he was wearing and just a few trickles onto the carpet. But it was enough to warrant a, hazmat situation.
Oh. Wow. Cool. Wow.
I'm so glad I don't have children.
Yeah.
So those of you thinking about having kids, just think about that a little bit more.
No. Okay. So Some Call It Lovin', also known as Sleeping Beauty, is directed by James B. Harris. But first we get in, before we get in the movie, let's talk about James B. Harris for a second. Jacob, you're a fan of James B. Harris, I know, because we kind of had this conversation already.
I am a massive fan of James B. Harris. I find him to be one of the more interesting, almost straight-up exploitation filmmakers that kind of ever worked. And, I mean, his whole history is kind of incredible, where you stretch, you know, he was Stanley Kubrick's, like, early producing partner.
Yeah, for The Killing and, like, Paths of Glory and stuff.
Wow. Paths of Glory and Lolita, too.
Yeah, correct? Lolita, yeah. they talk about that in the interview with him, actually.
I didn't have time to watch the interview. But, yeah, he did basically Killing, Paths of Glory, and Lolita with Kubrick. Produced another movie in between, Lolita and then his
directorial debut called The Bedford Incident, I believe.
Incident. Yeah, that's right. And then made Some Call It Loving. And, man, Some Call It Loving is I think it's wonderful, but it's so disconnected from the only other three films that he did after that, which he did two movies with James Woods, Fast Walking, which is like this great character piece about a prison guard with basically all these eccentric character actors in it. On top of, James Woods, there's also Susan Tyrell's in the film, Timothy Carey in one of his later very weird roles, as if there was ever a normal Timothy Carey role. You have Emmett Walsh, but that's a hell of a weird kind of drama comedy hybrid, but it's all this really, really interesting kind of character work and offbeat character work. But then he made Cop with James Woods.
which Cop is one of the better police films ever made. Like, it's so good, and it's probably my favorite James Ellroy adaptation. Like, he captures that innate sleaziness that Ellroy so, like, effortlessly kind of conveys via his writing. And also, Cop has the greatest – I don't want to ruin it for anybody. Might have the greatest final line in any film ever when he just lets loose those last three lines. And you're like, oh, shit. And then it just cuts to black. And you're like, this is the greatest movie I've ever seen.
Yeah. No, Cop is definitely his – I personally, other than Boiling Point, I mean – because, I mean, the guy's only done, like, five movies. But with just those five, but with Cop – just the plot of Cop and just James Woods, like, just his character, how it begins to the point of what 2 hours later, how it ends, just his dude, just like how crazy he can get without overdoing it. Like, it's just, you kind of get goosebumps just when you're watching the film, just how he reacts to, you know, being held back to where he is just about to fucking break. So
no, totally. But then, as you just mentioned, Boiling Point, which is another really, really great cop film. I don't think it's as good as Cop, but it's really, really solid and probably one of Wesley Snipes's better dramatic roles, to where we really get a solid performance out of Wesley Snipes. And then Dennis Hopper as Red Diamond, this kind of eternal con man, kind of trying to slither his way through, like, one last big score almost. It's definitely like a last big score to save his own life in this case. He's really, really amazing. And then you have a super young Viggo Mortensen just playing a straight up sociopath in that movie. But that is really, really cool. But again, peppered with these amazing character actors, as you have guys like Jonathan Banks in it, Tony LoBianco's in it, Seymour Cassell from all of those old John Cassavetes films. Like, it's a really, really wonderful movie. But again, Cops is masterpiece.
Yeah.
But this is kind of where I was going to go with that. I think Some Call It Lovin', while stylistically detached from kind of his cop noir stuff that he did later, kind of starts his obsession, is because even his cop movies are very adult cop films in how they deal with male-female relationships that – romantic and otherwise. I think Some Call It Lovin' is almost like the jumping off point for that, because Some Call It Lovin' is very, as we'll kind of get into, is very much a Dream Logic take on the ethics of being in a relationship and what it means to essentially love another person of the, you know, at all. And it's, I think it's really special, but I could also understand why people don't like it.
Yeah, I mean, with this, it felt, you know, even though it's based on a short story, to me it feels like there's something, you know, he didn't get into it in the interview, which I was hoping he would, because I had some questions, is if this is kind of more or less a personal experience of, you know, take away kind of the two women that Zalman's King character lives with, and kind of take away kind of the nymphomaniac type side, or kind of the oversexed thing, and just mostly focus on one guy who wants a girl, but ultimately when he achieves that, it's just not all what you thought it would be, you know. And I don't know, for me personally, it feels like that. Like, I can remember doing that, of like, you know, there was a girl that was, you know, had a boyfriend or something like that. And, you know, we were like, man, like, you really like this girl. And but she's taken, and this is the kind of the same thing where she's sleeping. And eventually you get to that point where you have that option to take it, and you do. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of regret it. And you just feel like – you wanted something that you couldn't have, but once you have it, you don't want it anymore. And that not meaning that, you know, the girl's shitty or something. It's just that that's a slice on life in general. And it felt like maybe that's just kind of a personal experience as well, you know, maybe for Harris to emulate this on screen. And that's kind of what it felt like to me.
Well, it's very much a movie about male ownership.
Right, because
in a very literal sense, because I mean, to kind of set it up for the people, I guess, listening who haven't seen
it. Yeah, we should, because this is very underseen. So
it's very much a movie about a young woman who is a sideshow attraction, a sleeping beauty who these guys essentially who pose as doctors drug her and keep her under and have kept her under for 8 years at this point.
Yeah, something like that.
And very much have like a almost like a carnival, you know, funhouse game to where they invite men from the audience to come in and kiss her to see if she'll awaken the sleeping beauty that she is, and they pay $1 per kiss. And Zalman King's character comes in and very much literally purchases her for $20,000, brings her to this giant opulent mansion that he lives in. You know, with these two women who dress up as nuns and dance. We'll get to that in a minute. And, you know, nurses her basically back to consciousness and even goes through this very odd and dreamy mock courtship with her all the way up to, you know, sex and marriage and everything. But it very much, to what Brad was saying, is about how almost the male psyche very much romanticizes the idea of like the perfect partner, the perfect white mate, or the perfect woman.
Yeah.
And then the experience, when the experience doesn't measure up, it's very much how they view that relationship, or even that idealized version of it doesn't live up to that, as disposable. But it's all packaged within this acidic daydream that is indebted to like Jess Franco and Radley Metzger and all of these sexploitation directors, but it's directed like a Kubrick movie. I mean, it's shot by Mario Tassi, who shot Carrie. Yeah.
Frogs.
Yeah, he shot Frogs. Killing Kind with John Savage. But he, you know, he did shoot Carrie. He did shoot The Stuntman, which is an extraordinary looking motion picture. He also shot Sybil too. So I mean, he's a very, very great cinematographer when he's on, and he is very much bringing that gauzy daydream vibe that he did to Carrie, to where like you just fall into this person's kind of hazy reverie more than anything.
Yeah, you feel – you get into the dreamlike sequence with Zalman King, because, I mean, watching this for the first time, you know, this is a film that I've never seen before. When he's at the carnival, I don't know. It's like, yes, purchase her. Like, you know, you want him – because you're thinking – it's almost like you're in the same state of mind he is. Like he's going mm-hmm. to save this girl in a sense, and he's going to – basically have this beautiful woman at his disposal and kind of make up any story that he wants and kind of create this woman that he wants. But once it happens, he realizes he can't do that. So it's also kind of a slap in the face to males, it feels like, at the same time, you know, is at one point it does feel kind of misogynistic in a way. But at the same time, it's like, you know, bro, you're not going to get everything that you dreamed of with this thing. Like, you know, you're in a fucking dreamlike state. Like, already he lives in this world that is kind of nutty, living in this like huge mansion with these two women, and he just wants more and more and more, and he just doesn't get it. And
the one woman plays almost like a very Pygmalion role with the Sleeping Beauty and dressing her up and teaching her how to be a lady. But it also feels, to kind of tie it back to Stanley Kubrick, is that it has that jazzy, that jazzy kind of daydream feel of Eyes Wide Shut. Is that you could see how maybe Kubrick looked to this movie too, or at least they were working together so closely that it might have bled through to Kubrick through osmosis, or creative osmosis in a way, in that, like, because Eyes Wide Shut kind of treads very, very close thematic ground in following this guy basically through this weird sexual adventure that essentially at first is his escape from his own marriage, only to return to his own marriage by the end. You know, and it's very much, again, dealing with the male idealizing of marriage and what sex inside of marriage means. Like, you could watch these two back to back and just, you'd have a field day thematically.
This is a weird movie to compare it to, but this is what I was seeing. Were you getting some vibes of Love Story, Arthur Hiller's Love Story with Ryan O'Neal?
Fuck, I never want to think about that movie again, so no. I hate Love Story so much. Like, I know we don't want to trash movies or whatever, but, like, Love Story is one of the worst films I've ever sat through.
Oh, really?
I hate it. Oh. I wrote about it I actually wrote about it when we did Blockbuster Month at BMD. I had never seen it before this year, actually. And I wrote about it on the site because we were doing the top grossing movies of each respective year, and I did Love Story. I was like, holy fucking shit, people went and saw it. Like, you can understand contextually and, like, from a historical standpoint, just in terms of, like, the post-Vietnam War and everything, and, like, how we needed a very happy, kind of almost sappy film, and you understand why Americans flocked to it at that point in our history. But looking back at it, I bet there's a lot of people who are like, man, I wish I could take that ticket back.
Wow. I personally love Love Story. So
get out. Stop.
I'm wanting to – I'll read that article. I missed that from you, so I'll definitely be reading that. I don't know. That's I got that kind of vibe because of – the reason why I like Love Story is kind of the same reason why I like Some Call It Lovin', is that they're both kind of dreamlike states. Is that something is there that's not really there. And I think that's why I like Love Story, is because it is kind of a slap in the face. Hmm? It's not all hyped up what it's supposed to be.
Well,
that's just me, though. I mean, it's a weird comparison. But I think the meaning of Love Story is not getting what you want and dream about. Is that there is heartbreak, there's hardships, there's fucking shit that happens. And I think that's kind of the same thing in Some Call It Lovin', is that you want this perfect thing, but there is no such thing as a perfect relationship. It's that people want everything to fall in. Like, just the tagline to the fucking movie and one of the lines is, you know, love is for never having to say you're sorry. Like, that's not true. It's one of the dumbest things ever. The whole point of relationships is that building blocks. And, you know, that's one thing that it feels that both movies just try to skip. They want to skip the working part and just have what they dream about and want. Like, what you sit when you're single and you sit in what you, like, formulate in your head as the perfect mate, but no work goes into building that and getting to that point. You just want to meet somebody and then immediately fucking fireworks go off, which it does. But then it's like, oh, something happens. So what the fuck do we do? Do we work through it, or do I just end up abandoning it? Like in, you know, something like not Love Story, but in Some Call It Lovin', like, do you really want to work towards that? I don't know if that makes any sense at all, but that's kind of like the vibe that I get from both of those films, completely different on different levels. But it just shows this kind of dreamlike state for people that just want things to fall in their lap. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I do know that Love Story is a piece of shit, though. I mean, really, what can you say about a 25-year-old girl who died, Brad? Really, what can you say? That she was beautiful, brilliant?
Well, dude, the movie's made in 1970. I think we're good. But back to Some Call It Lovin'. I think it's a great character piece on somebody that could buy, you know, have anything they want with the money, and, you know, a good looking guy is what he's supposed to be. Zalman King's kind of a goofball to me. ever since I saw Blue Sunshine, he's fucking a nutbag. Also in like Red Shoe Diaries and shit I used to watch on like Skinamax or whatever.
He has such an odd screen presence.
He does, because he's like semi-romantic but semi-perverted at the same time. Like, he could be the guy that rapes you, but he'll take you out for dinner first and show you a really good time.
Oh, what? <Jesus. laughs> He definitely has the air of a guy who would, like, without being invited, masturbate in front of you.
Yeah, he's the guy that, you know, you're having a conversation with the car and he just whips it out. That's yeah. But anyways, I totally got disconnected with that whole Zalman King thing. But I mean, just for a guy who could have anything he wants, and he can because of his wealth, but it's like he doesn't want to work for it. And I think it's just a good view on relationships in general in this movie. I think it's hidden in there. And that's the reason why I think it would be cool to have a conversation with James B. Harris to see if it's kind of a personal experience that he had.
Maybe. But what about the dancing nuns?
Well,
yeah,
I mean,
where do they come into play?
I think that's, again, that Kubrick, like, let's do something. I mean, if he didn't have the dancing nuns, I mean, if he didn't have a lot of things, I mean, if they weren't basically drugging her, it is... The movie is kind of a whole, like, dreamlike sequence and, you know, kind of out there. So I think it's fitting for the most part. I mean, I don't know if that's intentional or if it's just everybody was on drugs during the movie. That could be it, too. But I don't know. I think it's just that fantasy level with the dancing nuns, because he lives in a fantasy world.
Well, I was trying to see what it represented. I mean, at least to me, because it's a movie that's very much kind of drenched in symbolism. And to me, I wondered if the dancing nuns were supposed to be how he still kept religion in his house but distanced himself from it by always watching it as almost like another art form or another thing that he could collect and watch, which I thought was kind of interesting. There was something else too. Oh, what the fuck? Why is Richard Pryor in this movie? Like, it's so weird that Richard Pryor plays. It's kind of awesome because Richard Pryor's, it seems like he's riffing on that kind of junky archetype that he would perfect on stage with his stand-up stuff, because he's very much playing like a strung out wino character that also happens to be our main character, Zalman King's character, his best friend. Yeah. So it's a nut, but it's again another layer of kind of almost clashing weirdness.
How big is Richard Pryor's role in this film?
It's a decent size. Like, he's got a few scenes. Like, he's not a huge, you know, supporting cast
but
member.
But when he's on
like,
the screen, he's very noticeable. I mean,
yeah, he's Richard fucking Pryor.
Yeah. He's dishing it out, too.
Yeah.
Especially in the sequence of him right in the heart in the bathroom and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, he's really turning it out.
He's chain smoking. He's hanging out at a urinal at one point. Like, it's very much Richard Pryor doing the junkie thing, and it's intense. It might be the only thing, even though I enjoy it, it might be the only part of the movie that I can't place aesthetically or thematically.
Yeah, it's very out of, like, when it very first happens, it really catches you off guard.
Yeah,
because it doesn't fit the rest of the movie at all, and it just kind of comes out of nowhere, and you get into kind of not a main story, but you really dig deep down with his character and where he's coming from, because it's, you know, he's like, is he partially, you know, have retardation going on as well as he's a junkie? Because, like, something's not right upstairs. He's just not drawing a heart and doing these paintings because he's a junkie.
He seems like a street person, almost.
Yeah. So there's a little bit more to it. Like, he's just not all there. I mean, some bad shit happened to this guy. So it catches you off guard because you think that this is what it's going to be about for a second. Like, this is going to be kind of the co-star, and he's going to take him under his wing, but he just kind of shows up every once in a while.
Yeah, It's very strange. It's a strange creative decision.
Yeah, so I don't know. But it's a hell of a movie. It really is. Like, it's very bizarre. It's it definitely, you know, especially after, you know, in the interview, James B. Harris talks about, you know, Kubrick and working with him. You kind of really see that rub off. Like, he almost had something to prove, it seems, you know, working with somebody like Kubrick, that he's going to kind of do his own thing. So That definitely rubs off in the filmmaking aspect. And I think it's just a good take on, you know, love in general and relationships. Like, it's pretty out there, but I think it's all there for the most part. It's very distorted, but it's there.
Okay.
Hmm. Hey, how recent is that James Harris interview?
Oh, and all this stuff's new.
He's about, like, it's gotta be his late 80s by now, right?
Yeah, they do. I mean, he's pretty up there, man. They also do an interview with a cinematographer, too, which is pretty cool.
Mario.
Yeah.
Very nice.
But yeah, that's kind of watch Blue Sunshine. That's about it.
Yeah.
And it's definitely Zalman King's best performance.
Blue Sunshine is?
Yes, by far.
Okay.
Let me think. Yeah, probably.
Right? I mean, I can't really think. Okay, let's put it this way. Like, what Zalman King probably is like in real life is very close to that.
Is Jerry Zipkin from Blue Sunshine?
Even his name. You know, another weird, you know, would be good as kind of a double feature is this in Two Moon Junction.
That's a weird one.
Yeah,
I like Injunction, but it's a strange film,
dude. But that's what I'm saying. The same thing compared to like this, or maybe like Wild Orchid,
right?
Kind of the same thing.
I don't know if Two Moon Junction or anything Zalman King did by himself as like a director or writer really is working on the same level of art.
I'm saying for character wise. Character-wise, not filmmaking. I think for a Zalman King double feature.
Isn't Burl Ives in Two Moon Junction?
I don't remember, but that'd be hilarious if he is.
I'm pretty sure he was.
Oh man, Burl Ives is the man.
Burl Ives is the
snowman voice.
Burl Ives is the Richard Pryor of Two Moon Junction.
That's a good one, though. But Sherilyn Finn is in it, too, and she's super cute.
You definitely masturbated to that movie. There's
yes.
No
way. Oh, by far, dude. That movie's hot and heavy.
Well,
have you ever seen, shit, what is the fucking, After Dark, My Sweet?
Yes, I've seen
it. Dude.
How many times do you masturbate? Are we just going to start rating movies by how many times Brad masturbates to them?
I think so.
I mean, but
Brad,
seriously.
I think your next list is your next topic has arrived.
Yep.
Movies Top 10 I've movies that you masturbated to.
But dude, fucking After Dark, My Sweet is fucking good though. And it's sexy.
Yeah.
Very nice.
I think we can move on.
I think we're moving on.
I'm getting a little sweaty.
Let's move on.
Brad, what do you think about Tracy Lords?
Oh, dude, don't even get me started. I just fucking wrote a little thing about Shock 'Em Dead. Dude, fuck it. Tracy Lords is the shit. What are you talking about?
I missed Shock 'Em Dead. It just actually played the Ritz here in Austin as part of – they were doing Shred Timber for Tuesday, and it was all like horror metal themed.
Yeah, that's where I went to go see Trick or Treat.
Yeah, that's right. You saw Trick or Treat during
Fantastic Fest,
but they did Shock 'Em Dead too. And that was the one trailer where I just watched and I was like, I don't know about this movie.
It's weird. It's like if an amateur John Waters made a heavy metal movie.
Which is in itself quite strange because John Waters movies, which was another – that was the other Waters Wednesdays was Weird Wednesdays for the last month for Draft House, which was fun.
Yeah, why are you mentioning Tracy Lords? I mean, you want to talk about Tracy Lords for a second?
No.
Oh, okay.
I just wanted to throw it out there to see if I could actually hear your erection.
Did you hear it?
I did hear it. It groaned.
I have jeans on, so it's kind of easy to hear.
It's like that weird scraping sound, like when you're in church and you rub against the pew in front of you.
I've never been in church. Sorry.
That's fair.
You ever see Raw Nerve with Tracy Lords? David Pryor directed it.
I have seen Raw Nerve.
Yeah, I like that one quite a bit.
I'm sure you do. Anyway, we should move on.
Moving on. Moving on to the 1971 documentary?
No, the it's American definitely Dreamer. A documentary, yeah.
With starring Dennis Hopper.
This is, I just right now flat out say this is like literally one of my favorite things I've ever seen.
It is pretty damn incredible. He has a documentary crew following him around as he's, I think, in the editing of.
He's in the editing of his film,
The Last Movie. And I was trying to figure out, like, is this really Dennis Hopper? Is he putting on a character? Is he doing a, you know, I am, is it, what was that with the, is it, I am still here with, what's his face?
Joaquin Phoenix.
I was like, did Joaquin Phoenix kind of, was he inspired by the American Dreamer?
No, this is fucking Dennis Hopper.
Yeah.
This is how Dennis, like, yeah.
Cause I've read a couple different things, but,
Well, reading is one thing. Following Dennis Hopper and reading his book and just knowing like how he is in life.
Okay.
Like, yes, this is definitely Dennis Hopper in his truest form. The reason why Dennis Hopper can play the crazy roles is because he is a little bit out there. He's a very spiritual person. He's very, like, I mean, go back to kind of the history of Dennis Hopper when he very first started. I mean, he idolized James Dean. That's one of the very first actors he got to work with. I mean, he fucking knew Elvis Presley personally. This is all before Easy Rider as well. Mm-hmm. He became good friends with Vincent Price. Vincent Price, and you know, inspired and encouraged him to do more like theater. You know, so you have you know, all these like aspects and all these people that he met before Easy Rider. You know, because I mean, he was doing movies, you know, in the early 60s, late 50s,
yeah.
You know, as kind of a walk on actor, had some, and plus working one on one with, John Wayne,
yep.
You know, so he met all these incredible people that influenced him. So when he had that chance to do Easy Rider, and I think this is kind of where things sparked, is that you have a movie, Easy Rider, that is one of the more well-known films at that time. I mean, I think it's still pretty well-known. But, you know, you have, Dennis Hopper do this film that becomes huge and has always kind of been that. But let's just go back to, like, the late 60s when this came out and it, you know, was blowing up at the box office. You know, everybody loved it. It won awards. But when it comes down to it, when the first thing you mention, Easy Rider, you think Peter Fonda, and you think Jack Nicholson. I don't think Dennis Hopper comes to mind at first. And being that he is, you know, he wrote it with Peter Fonda, he was the director, the fame kind of didn't go towards Dennis Hopper. And I think that's where a lot of this sparked. And I think that's why the documentary is essential for the last movie, is because I think Dennis Hopper really, really had something to live up to. And I think he saw the fame that he gained, but at the same time, Peter Fonda and Jack Nicholson were the first things that were brought up when Easy Rider. Even though Dennis Hopper's in the film, you know, he wrote and he directed it, all the kind of the fame went to those two actors. And I think he had something to prove to other filmmakers, to the general public, to his friends. He really wanted to make something concrete and substantial to really show he's a director. So I think that's a lot of pressure for a person. And I'm glad that this was made, because I think that's kind of where that all stems from, is that, you know, I think he kind of lost himself with, you know, maybe alcohol and drugs, trying to live up to this and, you know, succeeding, of course. But, you know, I mean, if you've seen the last movie, this documentary, and if you watch this documentary and then you watch the movie or vice versa, like, you could totally see some shit going on. I mean, because it truly, last movie is truly experimental. And I think that's kind of what he wanted to do. He wanted to make something completely different. So I don't think this is an act. This is just him gaining that success, living that success, and then wanting to accomplish more and live up to what – I mean, this is fucking directorial debut, you know, making something such a substantial as easy, living up to that. I think that kind of really got to him. Yeah. And I think this documentary truly shows that side of just filmmaking in general and trying to be better and do better.
Yeah.
At the same, you know, that's just me.
Well, I mean, Lawrence Schiller was the one who basically was following him around, and I believe in an interview he said that Hopper always knew that he was being filmed, so he did kind of play to the camera a little bit. He was always aware, so he didn't. I think Schiller isn't even sure if he got the true Dennis Hopper like he was intending to get. But like you said, like, it could, I mean, he looks like he's on some shit, so.
That was a common, you know, it's not like this movie, you know, was made 2 years ago.
Well, no, I mean, everyone
This is in the 70s where, you know, drugs were a lot more, you know, pure and weren't fucking tampered with and, you know, fucking laced with shit. It was more or less natural, so there wasn't any, you know, hardcore, you know, people fucking dying on the side of the road. Fuck. I mean, there was that, but it wasn't as, you know, common as it is fucking binging and shit like that. And, you know, people going out and fucking driving cars and dying, you know, it was more or less, let's fucking do drugs and sit around together and fucking talk about movies and music.
Yeah.
You can see, they are all fucking sitting in a circle swaying at one point in this movie.
It's also worth noting that this was the time of Manson too. Mm. Manson is even specifically referenced in the film as in a positive light, because Hopper even brings Manson up by name. I think what's interesting about American Dreamer is that it very much captures that counterculture that was always on the verge of absolute madness, because you have Dennis Hopper out in the desert, you know, editing this movie and stuff, but then he's shooting automatic weapons. He's obviously dropping acid and drinking. He's having, you know, group sex. This is very much there's an almost cultish vibe to the family of followers who's kind of surrounding him at this point. Because what were the dates when this was shot? Does anybody know?
It was 1970, 1971. I mean, not the exact dates.
Because, I mean, the Manson murders were committed...
It was 1970. It was right after... It was Easy Rider was 69. Was when that came out, so...
Manson murders were June 16th, 1970. So okay. There's a fair chance that Manson murders were committed possibly while this was being filmed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they coincide almost exactly. So it's interesting to take this and, like, almost as a historical document beyond talking about the American New Wave and talking about the last movie and its relationship to Easy Rider is more its relationship almost to the fringe counterculture of the time and the counterculture that Dennis Hopper very much belonged to that was on the brink of madness at almost all turns, which is it. The movie sat with me really weird as this dual piece of both cinematic history and also just American history of, like, this is what it was like in these times, and this is how close that even our greatest artist came to being insane people, or were insane people in a way, because the last movie ended up pretty much exiling Dennis Hopper from Hollywood for
decade. Went to go hide. He went in the desert, you know?
Exactly.
But I mean, also in 1970, you would have had fucking Nixon as president as well, which, you know, that changed a lot of shit for a lot of people. And I think, you know, that obviously has something to do with just, you know, the economy and things like that, just how people, you know, looked at things. And also the same time as what fucking movie won Oscar in 1970, 1969, 1970? Because, I mean, Easy Rider was nominated.
Wasn't Love Story nominated in 1970? I'm actually being serious.
Probably.
Love Story won some.
Was it Midnight Cowboy? Ooh, I got it before you. I didn't even look. So, I mean, you have an X-rated movie at that point winning Oscars. So I think a lot of that, you know, Hopper wanted to kind of live up. He saw what was kind of happening and the trends that were happening in Hollywood and wanted to do something different. I mean, fucking Midnight Cowboys winning an Oscar. You know, I mean, think about that winning an Oscar now.
Yeah, it'd be impossible.
Right. So, you know, you have Hopper really trying to, I mean, you think about all that pressure for a person. It is maybe somebody as, you know, meeting all these people in so little time in his life, meeting these ginormous people to him. I mean, fucking James Dean, John Wayne, all these people helping him with his career, backing him up. He's got to this point, and now what does he do? So I think, you know, this in I think it's very insightful in his life, just kind of letting loose and kind of going crazy. Yeah, going in the desert, shooting guns. He might be putting a little bit on for the camera, but he's actually right there, right then, doing that shit.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he's in his film for sure.
Right. He might be, you know, putting it on a little bit, maybe saying a couple lines crazy, you know, here or there. But as history shows now, okay, at that point, maybe he's putting it on for the camera. But fucking Dennis Hopper strapped dynamite to himself in a fucking coffin and blew himself up in the dynamite chair act in the 80s. Like, the dude's fucking legitimately, like, kind of insane. Like, if you don't believe me, go to fucking YouTube, type in dynamite chair death act and watch him like have fucking explosives strapped to this fucking coffin and blowing himself up.
Right.
Like, it's insane.
And I was also wrong. I forgot Manson murders are 1969, but
no, I think I still think it was influenced. Yeah,
but I mean, Nicholson, who's one of Hopper's best friends, is attending Manson's trial in 1970. At that point,
wow. Oh shit! Yeah.
So, like, there's some really odd historical things going on in this film, and at the same time, you have it being, you know, directed by L.M. Kit Carson, who would go on to write
Texas Chainsaw 2. He would go on to write Paris, Texas for Wim Wenders. He would write the Breathless remake with Richard Gere.
Oh, so, shit. Like, yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's some interesting credits going on here, and he's the one. That's why I don't know if I 100% buy the Hopper's playing an act for the camera at all, because like L.M. Carson was very much – I mean, he was an artist too. He wasn't just some guy with a camera who came in to follow him. Like, he was on his way up as well.
You mentioned, you know, fucking Texas Chainsaw Massacre too, because Dennis Hopper kind of plays the same character.
No, exactly.
He plays Lefty,
yeah.
You know, but in a way, I could totally see your point, and I don't think we'll ever know, because I mean, Kit Carson's, you know, obviously passed, yeah, but he not died like what, like a couple years ago,
2014, last year, wow. Last oh, October. Shit.
Oh wow, damn. But. Honestly, maybe that's something like I'm writing this fucking crazy role for Hopper because he can really churn this out. I mean, look at fucking Blue Velvet. You know, he's just – it's kind of the attitude that Hopper has always had. He's very gung-ho with everything. But I think that's just part of his personality. You know, he's I think it would be unfair to call him crazy, but he can really turn that crazy on when he wants to. And yeah, he might have done it a little bit more because, I mean, obviously this camera crew is going around saying, hey man, you just fucking did Easy Rider. Let us film you during the editing of, you know, your latest motion picture. Well, fuck yeah, man. Come on and let's do this shit. That's, of course, the attitude he's going to have. Mm-hmm. You know, and then, of course, you know, was it Universal or whoever stepped in and, you know, kind of to want to not do – it's kind of a fun history with the movie because, you know, history shows with the making of the film and the release is that I think it was Universal. Universal didn't want this to be done. So Dennis Hopper kind of – he was set on as a producer but then slowly backed away and didn't want to get involved because there was – you know, they said you cannot release this theatrically, this documentary. So what they ended up doing was is that back in the day, college campuses were the biggest like – kind of money makers for movies like in the 60s and in the 60s and the 70s. So if it was released at college campuses, it wasn't considered a theatrical release.
Correct.
So they went ahead and they did this and they released it in college campuses. And so that's how they got the movie out. And technically Universal couldn't do anything because it was a loophole.
Wow. Well, then, like, one of the colleges, they got in trouble.
Yeah.
That's how the movie got buried for years, because one of the colleges, like, four-walled the theater off campus, and then that gave Universal the grounds to basically file an injunction against it and basically keep it from being seen for years and years and years.
Yeah, and then years later, Dennis Hopper remembered it and then wanted to go through and kind of show the world, and then it went back on its, you know, festival tour, but, you know, underground tour being screened here and there, and then, of course, the prints were found, and now we have it. But I think it's kind of a, you know, a kind of a cool history with Hopper and just who he truly is, because from interviews to – because I followed Hopper a lot. I think he's an incredible actor. He's definitely one of my favorites. And, you know, just with this – I really enjoyed it, even though he's kind of – he is an asshole, like huge asshole sometimes in this documentary. But at the same
massive
time –
misogynist too.
Oh, God, dude. Yes. So bad. Like – One of my favorite parts, but also it's like really fucked up, is that when he's sitting there and he's like, the problem with a nymphomaniac is trying to get him to come. Like, you know, and I was like, God, dude, I'm fucking, what is wrong with you?
I kind of had to do like a double take, like what did he just say?
So, but no, I think it's a good, you know, character piece and a character study just on a human being in general, living up, because I mean, take any other filmmaker, I mean, and think about the pressure that was involved. I mean, think about well, Tarantino is probably different because he knew he was hot shit. But I mean, making something like Reservoir Dogs and then waiting until that next movie. I mean, we have that all the time. We have filmmakers that have such a substantial debut. Like, what are they going to do next? You know, that pressure that's involved. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a good aspect just on in filmmaking in general for any filmmaker, you know, worrying about what you're going to do next and what you're going to become. You know, I find it very, very intriguing. And you know, that's why I like this so much is to watch this man kind of just lose it in a way. And I don't know. It could be an act. It couldn't. Who knows? But it's still Hopper being Hopper.
Oh, yeah.
You know? So I personally, I think this is fucking phenomenal. I think it's fucking great. So I'm happy to finally see it. And I think it truly is like, I mean, watching this and the last movie back to back is like mind blowing to me.
Agreed.
I was about to say, were you about to say something, Jacob?
Not really. I mean, I totally agree with what Brad's saying. I don't know if I was as on board with it because I don't know how much I could recommend it to people who don't have the baseline knowledge to appreciate it. Like, this is very much a deep cut for people already interested in either this time period or Dennis Hopper, because you can't just show this to somebody, you know, cold. They'll be like, what is the point?
I totally showed it to my wife, and she was interested. She came in as I was watching it. She kind of got disinterested after a while, but for – just kind of based on a historical thing, like she was interested in like the 70s and everything and the music and just how everyone was acting, you know, around each other and the weird, the parties. And so she was definitely interested in that aspect. I mean, you know, she's couldn't really, remember like where she'd seen Dennis Hopper, like what movies, you know, like I think Speed was the one that the number one that she was like, oh yeah, that guy. You know,
fucking Speed.
But I think there is interest there. But yeah, it is a deep cut. It'd have to be somebody who likes documentaries and things like that. You can't just watch this Dennis Hopper thing. You know,
I completely agree with that. But also, I think it's a very intimate portrait on just someone. Because I mean, with a lot of documentaries, we go in without knowing kind of the background. I mean, I think that's the beauty of documentaries is going in without knowing and learning about something that is unknown. And I think this is, yes, they don't get into the filmmaking aspect of kind of the Easy Rider and, you know, the history of what inspired the last movie, which was an experience that Hopper had back in, you know, the 50s. And you know, the success of Easy Rider and then coming off of that, making this, they don't dive into that too much, but I think it's a good kind of character piece and a character study and an intimate portrait of a man's life trying to accomplish something. Yes, they don't achieve it in the documentary. So I understand what you're saying, how it would be a deep cut because there's obviously some historical factors that play into that to fully comprehend everything. But I think as just kind of a documentary alone, if people are really into documentaries, I think they would dig it. Yeah. But I think coming cold, yeah, I think that could definitely throw some people off. But I think for anybody that at least knows kind of, you know, Hopper and Hopper's history and just, you know, how he works in the movies that he's involved with and the projects, I think people could get into it. I really think they could.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, it's an interesting thing. You know, I think you may have to be in the right mindset for it, but
yeah, you have to be in the mood for something like this because it definitely can catch you off guard. Because I mean, I'm a big Hopper fan, and I kind of know how he is. And at first, I was like, I was actually watching it, and Janice was doing schoolwork, sitting on her laptop, and she looks over, and she goes, "What the hell are you watching?" And I'm like, oh, it's, you know, this documentary. He goes, can you give me the headphones? I don't want to watch this pretentious shit. So, you know, there you go.
Do you get that a lot in your house, or he just looks over and goes, what the hell are you watching?
Yeah, no, I get that a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because sometimes I, you know, after Willow goes to bed, I'll pull out something that's really fucking weird, or, you know, some shot on video shit, and she'll walk in and she won't understand. Which most people don't, I guess, but that's fine.
Especially when you're masturbating to it.
Especially.
Yes.
I think for fans of film and fans of film history and restoration and things like that, I think this thing's a, you know, something you'd want to add to your collection. Because there's a great documentary on how they, you know, restored it and, you know, and where the prints were and everything.
Yeah, no, it's called A Long Way Home. It's really fucking good.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's only 7 minutes, but it's really, like, that 7 minutes, you really comprehend, like, everything that kind of went into this.
It's a packed 7 minutes.
Yeah, like, it's really fucking good editing on the little miniature documentary.
Anything else on this? Because that's the only thing that I watched. I know there's other...
Yeah, there's a making of featurette it's kind of, I don't know, it's okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as insightful as a 7-minute doc.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I think Etiquette Pictures is out with a bang. Coming out the gates with a bang here.
Yeah, these fucking two releases, like... I mean, I'm proud to hold these two in my hand. Like, this is something that you can really, like, if you, are you making, are you think I'm telling a dick joke?
No, yep. well, kind of.
All right, never mind. I'm done.
I'm just so glad to hold this in my hand.
I don't know. I think it's a cool little, you know, two movies.
Excuse me.
Brad, I think you're a cool little two movies.
Thanks.
Well, what I think it shows also where Etiquette Pictures is going, like, with these types of films. Like, just how Vinegar Syndrome has always wanted to curate kind of the weird and odd films that no one else really wants to pay attention to. Other than that, there's certain other ones that they release, you know, like Madman and things like that, that had a following. But, you know, things like Nightmare Weekend and just, what's the one with the guys who are worm farmers?
Runaway Nightmare.
Yeah. Things like that. Here we have Etiquette Pictures looking for things that, you know, a little more on the art house, you know, side of things, but still,
yeah, like,
they're interested in finding things that, like, not even Criterion's gonna touch.
Did you fucking see that reverse sleeve for American Dreamer, though?
Oh, is there a reverse sleeve? I don't even know.
Oh, God, dude. There's reverse sleeves for both of them.
Nice.
But the reverse sleeve is just a huge picture of fucking Dennis Hopper with a fucking cigarette in his mouth.
Nice.
It's black and white. It's pretty fucking pimp. That's all I'm saying.
He does look good, especially holding that.
Whoa.
I know, he does. In all the denim.
Speaking my language now.
The cigarettes and the guns. I mean, you know, that dude is a posing machine with all that stuff. That's the thing about the 70s is everyone had a cigarette hanging out of their mouth.
I guess.
And everyone looked like they hadn't taken a shower in about a week.
Yeah, the first scene, fucking Hopper's out of the shower.
Well, I know, but he still looked like he needed a shower and he was done.
Yeah, you definitely see Dennis Hopper's taint. It's really weird. Yeah.
He gets naked a lot, which is kind of fun. I mean, good.
Wow. All right.
If you know what I'm talking about.
Awesome. All right. I think we can move along here.
Yeah.
But I'm really excited to see, you know, there's Etiquette Pictures. What else do they have coming along? They have a Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, right?
Yeah, there's some blaxploitation in the pipes.
Yep.
Really, oh, they're doing Sweet Sweetback.
Yeah, they're doing
Dolemite and a couple other things.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Those are cool. Like, those are titles that people actually know, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, they got some cool shit. They're even promising bigger and better things next year, so we'll
see. All right.
Awesome. All right. Let's jump into our two segments here.
Yes.
Here we go. Let's start out with video. Oh, my God.
Why? We do stream screams first.
What?
We do stream screams first, usually.
I don't care.
Nate, wake up!
There's something very important I forgot to tell you.
Don't fucking scream at me!
Scream, I'll break your neck. Don't scream, miss. Don't scream.
All right, let's talk about stream screams. He knows you're alone.
Jackass. Okay, fine. Stream screams. He knows you're alone.
He knows you're alone.
Wow. This one is most notoriously known for one of, I think it was Tom Hanks' first, was it his first role or an early role?
I think it was his first one.
In 1980. And, you know, kind of another slasher. But this one, the victims are women who are about to get married. Is that correct?
Bridal. Yeah, bridal parties.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm kind of hit or miss with slashers. But
okay, you're done.
Let me finish. I had a lot of fun with this one. And it's probably one of my favorite 80s slashers I've seen in quite a while. So,
Jesus, really?
Well, I mean, you know.
Okay.
I'm pretty harsh with slashers, and I have
he hates everything. If it's not Bay, no way.
Shut up.
So, but I mean, this is coming off the success of course, Halloween, like most slashers did in the, you know, 1980s and 1981. But I think this one's a little bit more unique because, yes, they do kind of follow those slasher tropes, but at the same time, it's like, boom, here's your killer. This is who you're going to be afraid of the whole entire movie. And I kind of like that approach to this. Rather than, you know, making it an unseen killer the whole time, we're very aware what this guy looks like. So we're kind of trying to look for him on screen just the same as kind of our characters are. And even though it might not be the most eventful slasher there is, but I think I can appreciate them trying to do something a little newer with kind of how everything was going.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think when knowing who the killer is, I think it's a little bit more suspenseful than having a mass killer, because when you have a mass killer the whole time, unless it's something like Michael Myers, where you know who's behind the mask, you just don't see his face, which is scary. But when you're trying to figure out who the killer is, it kind of takes the fun out of movies sometimes, because I think too many people are set to try to figure out who it is before the movie ends. And I think that kind of takes you out of the picture a little bit when you're watching it. I think going in and knowing that person, and I think that increases the sense of dread for films like this. So, you know, you're waiting for that person to show up. You're not waiting for that, you know, medium shot with the person's head cut out with just their chest and the fucking gloves on with a knife, you know, dressed in black. You're not seeing that. You're actually seeing killer in full focus right off the bat. And I think that does help in a way, knowing who your killer is. And I think that's kind of the difference with this film.
Well, he's kind of like the proto Russ Thorne in that regard.
He looks like Russ Thorne.
Yeah, doesn't he?
Yeah, like when it first comes out, I was like, "Holy shit, is this a Russ Thorne movie?"
Yeah,
yeah, like he totally looks like those like batshit crazy eyes, like wide open. He's totally fucking. I'm glad you said, because I was actually going to mention that. It was in my notes. Fucking Russ Thorne.
He looks just like the killer, or at least I guess mold for the killer for Slumber Party Massacre. But I don't know, like, I think this movie is very much, I mean, it's very much the Halloween riff, because it even steals whole shot setups from Carpenter's Halloween. I mean, even with having, you know, the three girls.
Totally.
Best friends and walking down the street. And that's the other thing, is these are all supposed to be like graduate school, you know, aged girls and women, young women who are about to get married, and they still, and
speak and act very much like teenagers when they're together. So it almost feels like this guy making this movie about young women, but there was either some like studio exec or somebody on the rewrites saying like, oh, no. They have to talk more like the three girls from Halloween, like 100%.
No, I mean, I think that's the, you know, the target audience they were trying to hit too, you know.
Right.
I think it was one of those things where it probably is, you know, filmmakers' point and also studio coming in saying, hey, you know, well, we have to market this towards, you know, teenagers, so we don't want everybody talking to fucking bridal shit because, you know, we want 15-year-olds in the fucking theater or younger watching this, you know, slasher film. So, of course, yeah, I think that's a good, you know, a good outlook on it is that, you know, your kids, your adults, quote unquote, are very childlike and childish.
Yeah. And then so. It's again, another movie that's interestingly peppered with familiar faces. You have Paul Gleason, most will know from The Breakfast Club, mm-hmm. you know, as the one detective. You have Tom Hanks, obviously. You have James Rebhorn. Yeah, as the philandering professor. It's a really well cast movie, but I also kind of like the whole idea of killing brides right before their wedding. Is it does two things for me. Is A, it's like inherently mean-spirited. Like that's like the meanest fucking thing you could do. It's like, oh, you're about to enjoy the happiest day of your life. Now I'm going to murder you.
Right.
And then B, it almost feels like a direct update of what Carpenter was doing with Halloween in terms of taking this symbolism of what we kind of associate safety with and with – because with like Halloween, you have the suburbs being attacked by essentially this faceless evil that's just preying on these young women. In this film, it's very much taking the imagery of what people associate with the happiest day in a woman's life and having it be violated by this man who's coming in to stab them. And it's again, it's subverting that idea of safety that the slasher film does really well. It just sucks that the rest of the movie is kind of boring.
Well, yeah, I think they were leaning on because the cool thing about Halloween is that it builds that sense of dread. I think they were really trying to do that, especially with, you know, our lead, Amy, I think is her name, kind of the – yeah, whatever her name is. But she, you know, trying – you know, dealing with seeing him. You know, she sees him when she's getting ice cream. She sees him, you know, at the – you know, the fair. Sees him actually inside one of the rides. But – I don't think there's that emotional attachment to her as like we had with like Laurie Strode.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's because of acting, if it's because of script, mainly probably because of the script, because of what, you know, maybe the film was originally trying to be. Cause I can also kind of see this film leaning towards kind of a giallo mean spirited thing with the brides. Like, you know, what if you gave this filmmaker full reign to do what he wants? You know, it could have been kind of a giallo slasher, but instead we got this like pseudo like Halloween spin in order to please audiences at the movie theaters at that time.
Yeah.
So it can go both ways. I mean, another movie that I would kind of like to know, like, kind of the back history, you know, production-wise of something going on. This is the reason why the movie always fascinated me, because it seems that it can't find a place. Like, it wants to be all these different movies, but was trying to be so many different things that it couldn't find and solidify one thing. It was just kind of stealing from all these different movies, and then that's it.
Well, I like that it does steal from other movies, but I like that it also, you know, once Tom Hanks appears and they're at the amusement park, like he's kind of commenting on horror films and being scared or what it means to be scared or why, because he's like a psych major or something like that. I thought that was pretty clever. when they're bringing that up.
I thought of that when I was watching it too, is that he almost seems like the very, very like almost like caveman version of what would essentially become Randy from Scream.
Right, exactly. Like, yeah.
The guy who just shows up to comment on the film itself.
Yeah.
Well, this is a huge movie inspired for Scream. That's Kevin Williamson got the Randy character from him.
Oh, really?
So he fucking steals the opening of He Knows You're Alone for Scream 2.
Oh, that's right, with the fucking movie theater and shit.
Yeah, this is a huge influence for Scream.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a huge influence. I mean, Kevin Williamson has always loved this movie, but yeah, that's there was an interview where he even said the Randy character is kind of, you know, it's a mixture of this. What he said was is that there's like, you know, a few horror films in his life where he saw the characters in the films kind of be self-aware of the reality and the harshness of maybe a killer in the real world, comparing them to movies. Mm-hmm. And that was one of them. And also, I mean, fucking, yeah, the opening to Scream 2 is the fucking this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I love the opening to this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it just Scream 2 did it better.
It's horrifying the way they do it in this one, much more than Scream 2. I mean, you kind of just put yourself in that situation too, you know.
I think it's that same thing as, kind of what Halloween did. If someone screams in Halloween, no one's going to go running. If someone screams in the theater, no one's going to go running.
Exactly.
I think it's just putting people in that situation where you wouldn't raise a flag if you heard something out of the ordinary, because the ordinary is the common. Yeah. So, and too bad the movie doesn't follow suit like the opening so much, but, you know, it's, I think of all the kind of the, you know, all the slashers, the abundance of slashers that came out, He Knows You're Alone is at least trying to achieve something different by little things, and that's what sticks out for me, versus kind of just, you know, a slice and dice movie.
Yeah.
Like, they literally did try a few new things, but like I said, they were trying to also copy a lot of things and not be able to a movie to for it to stand on its own.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the reason why it is very underseen and kind of one of the slashers that's a lot lower on the list. Cause, I mean, this thing had a fucking DVD release at one point. Now it's like super out of print, and now it's thrown up on Vudu, at least in HD, which is cool.
Yeah.
So,
it's cool seeing like how great of an actor Tom Hanks was even back then, because once he appears, it's like he's, and I don't know if it's just because we're familiar with him, you know, but
I think it's because you're familiar with him
on another level, you know, but maybe that is just because we're just used to him, we're used to seeing him, but it's really fun to see him, you know, show up in the flick.
But I don't know, I think it's a good entry, you know, with slashers if you're trying to get into it, or you know, I think it's a fun movie. I mean, there's, think of all the fucking slashers and all the fucking horror movies. I think this is definitely one of the more well-made ones, for sure. And, you know, definitely a film that's inspired by the genre in general. Just too bad they tried to copy so much of everything that was happening.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Sure.
Sure. But no, I enjoyed it. It's definitely worth a rent on Vudu, and it's, what is it, like $17.99 to buy on Vudu?
I can't remember. I think I bought it, and it was actually pretty cheap when I bought it. I don't know if it was like on sale or something.
But, you know, I think this is, I don't know who this is. I thought this is by Lionsgate now, who owns it, so that means that obviously we're not going to get any DVD or Blu-ray release of it.
I thought it was a Warner title.
I don't know
either.
I was thinking MGM.
If it's MGM, that might be nice. You might get a Blu-ray from Scream Factory or something.
Yeah, maybe I rented it. I think I rented it. It's like $13.99, so I highly doubt I bought it.
It's still not too bad for, you know, for something like this that's unavailable on, you know, DVD for right now.
Yeah, the DVD is an out of print Warner like archive style title.
Okay.
No, I have it here actually on my desk.
It says Warner Brothers on Vudu, and I do own it. I did buy it.
Yeah, it is Warner Brothers DVD. Yeah. So, hey, $40
now.
It will still not be released on Blu-ray Warner Brothers.
You won't be seeing this. But, and we talk about this all the time whenever we do the segment is, you know, I feel like a lot of companies are just unloading their horror titles digitally because it's probably cheaper, you know, and who knows? Who knows if they're tracking the interest or not, but at least they're available somewhere in a decent picture, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the HD version of this looks really good. You know, I have it on DVD. It definitely looks better than the DVD.
Yeah.
So definitely for $13.99 versus what it costs to fucking buy an out of print DVD for $50, I think it's worth it for sure.
Yeah. Very cool. So, all right. Now let's move into video. Oh my god.
Dude, you sound like you're fucking.
Nikki.
Well, here we are at last. Right where we ought to be. Video.
Oh my god!
This is a film that I don't think I've ever heard of before Brad mentioned it. It's called.
Most people have it.
It is called House of Yellow Carpet, or House of the Yellow Carpet.
House of the Yellow Carpet.
It's from 1983, and I think I was expecting kind of a giallo-type film. It isn't.
Most people are, because it's
Italian.
That's how it's promoted as.
But it seems a lot more subtle, a lot more laid-back than just a giallo. It's more of a...
It's more of a murder mystery.
Yeah, murder mystery, and I think this was based off of a stage play. Because it felt very stagey. You know, like the movie Bug, you know, very contained in one area. I thought that I read that it was based on a stage play. I could be wrong, but it felt that way.
It looks like it feels very much like the giallo take on like Hitchcock's Rope,
huh?
Which is single space.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that too. I remember you mentioning that. It's like, you know, I think what kind of made this film kind of suffer is it being kind of promoted as a giallo, because mm-hmm. even when you look it up, it still says Italian giallo. I think,
well,
to me, there is
yellow's a giallo in Italian.
Mm. Right, I understand mm-hmm. that.
So that's why they do it.
Mm.
But it's
Brad,
still considered. Are you fucking kidding me? This it's promoted still as giallo film. I understand that giallo means yellow, but I'm still saying that when people say giallo, do you think that you're going to get, you know, this Dario Argento, you know, black rubber gloves around a woman's neck and blood dripping down her breasts? It's immediately like what people think of. You know, you're going to get something that's heavy, that's violent, you know, that's really well shot, that's very colorful. And honestly, I think in a way, giallo has also spread to just kind of a style of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Suspiria, I think, is a great example of that. Because, I mean, Suspiria, if you take the traditional giallo film, Suspiria is not that. It's more or less kind of a style of filmmaking, and it follows suit to Argento's style, which I think he's, you know, he's the main proponent of saying, hey, you know, let's kind of go this direction with this. You know, The Man Who Knew Too Much, you know, Bava started that kind of that mysterious, you know, murder mystery, and Argento took it to another level, make it more stylistic. So I think that's kind of the aspect that we need to look at this film on, rather than making it, you know, kind of a slasher with a killer with black gloves.
Yeah, I mean, there is still somewhat of a gore element to it in small doses, but it is actually based on a play called Theater at Home by Aldo Soleri.
Cool.
FYI.
Wow. Yep. That's really going to help us right now.
It's I thought it was interesting.
Uh-huh. What else do you find interesting?
I don't know. But what is the plot? Can we get into a consensus on what the plot is?
I think the plot is the reason why this movie's always intrigued me is that I forget how I came across. I mean, I have the tape of it. It was just one of those things where I thought, probably I was buying box lots off of eBay when I was 16, buying, 100 movies, from going out of business video store or whatever. And I just came across it because the title always intrigued me because it really is a boring title, but right. it also does intrigue you because you're like, what the fuck, what does the yellow carpet have to do with anything? And I remember originally reading about the plot, I always mention All Movie Guide, from the 90s. I remember reading on there that the carpet made you kill people. So that's the reason why I wanted to watch it. But then when I watched it, I was like, what the fuck is this? Like, this is not what it is. It's a very, kind of murder mystery. Another movie that has the place, that sense of dread of why, this guy that keeps coming to this house that wants to, buy this carpet that this, this couple has. So, but I mean, ultimately that's kind of what it is. It's about this couple decides to sell a rug, essentially, that was a gift to them, and then this guy comes around wanting to buy a carpet, and it kind of goes into of why he wants the rug back. Or why he wants the rug in general. So it becomes kind of that murder mystery of what this guy has done, the reason why he wants this carpet back, what does the carpet hold, does the carpet turn you into a murderous being is what I thought when I was younger. But, I think it's a unique movie. It's something that you don't pick up and you really see every day.
Yeah.
So that's the reason why I've always kind of been partial to this one. And also it just never got much play. It was just one of those really underseen movies I've seen, that I've always known about.
I would love to see a decent print of this for sure.
Yeah.
I saw the VHS version and there's, it is in one location pretty much, but it seems like they tried to do a lot with, some cinematography and the color, like that yellow carpet and everything, but yeah, I would love to see it in a higher quality
picture. Yeah, I think with, it being a better quality picture, I think we'd get that sense of isolation and that sense of confinement in this movie, because, there's minimal characters in this film. We have the two that we have the couple that's selling the rug. We have the stranger and then somebody else. I don't think there's very many other characters other than that. And pretty much the whole, and another reason why it was probably a stage play is that it takes place in the apartment pretty much the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a few things with, a decent print of this movie being, transferred to DVD or Blu-ray, or any, digital service, I think we could really, bring out the colors, we could bring out, the soundtrack to give us that sense of confinement. And I think that's what works in this kind of, this bizarre film in general, is that, you really can't go anywhere. And I like, films that take place in one location, they're fun because it gives you that sense that there is no outside world. And, you don't ever really have to ask that question because once your character kind of goes outside, it's like, well, why don't you just leave? When the characters don't leave and they're confined to one area, it makes you feel that the whole world is just right in that room. And I don't know, I find that intriguing and fun.
Yeah.
So.
Very cool.
It also works as a real interesting to kind of bounce off of the whole idea of the giallo and how it kind of
plays with it is that it almost acts as a neat deconstruction of like giallo themes that are usually found, because it's very much about these guys, not to spoil anything, but about basically a woman being attacked in her home and then finding out the truth behind the attack, into the point of almost being like a movie that psychoanalyzes the typical kind of giallo woman protagonist. And obviously there's a twist at the end of the film that allows you to kind of go into that a little more. But I thought it was really neat. It almost becomes like a meta film about this weird Italian genre.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some twists and turns that I think for sure the movie messes with you and messes with the audience. I just would think that would kind of be, you know, the film would be a lot larger scale if it was bigger. I think it would have made more of an impact, but sadly it didn't. I mean, yeah. It was basically unheard of this whole entire time and still is, you know, very underseen.
Yeah, the thing is, like, how, you know, it's frustrating when we do these because it's like, how can people catch these, you know? I think there is a version on YouTube. There's a rip of it there.
Yeah, I think it was released on DVD, like an Italian DVD.
Okay.
Because I think I remember seeing it on Diabolik DVD, but I don't even know if it had American, you know, or not American, but English subtitles. So I don't, it's just one of those things that, you know, I like talking about these films, but at the same time, it's like, where do you obtain them?
Yeah.
You know, you have to go through, you know, a couple obstacles maybe to see them. They're not legal obstacles, but the point is that, you know, we have all these companies, you know, like, for example, I mean, we talked about two films that were kind of lost already, you know, with Some Call It Loving and, you know, The American Dreamer. There's plenty of other films. So if we talk about them, somebody's got to be, you know, discussing them and sharing them in order for, you know, something to spark, or for another company to listen and be like, oh, these guys are talking about this movie. Let's check it out and save it. Because I think this is definitely a film that probably could be saved, because I haven't checked the price on Amazon for the tape, but I'm pretty sure it's quite up there. I mean, I've only seen my copy. I have a copy on tape, but that's it. You know, I've never seen it anywhere else. I don't remember seeing it on the shelf as a kid. So, you know, this is definitely something that needs to be saved. The fucking Crypt of Living Dead could be on Blu-ray. Fucking House of the Yellow Carpet can. Definitely more entertaining.
Totally, yeah. It's a better film than Crypt of Living Dead, for sure. Yeah, $49 for a VHS tape.
Yeah, used. See, that's what...
There's a brand new one for $199.
See, that's what I'm saying. Like, I mean, fucking, I have it on tape, but what the fuck am I going to do with it? You know, it's one of those things that no one's going to pay $50 to, you know, buy a tape.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a huge avid tape collector. I've never fucking bought a tape for $50. You know? So, I mean, who the fuck's going to do that? Yeah, it's out of print, but, you know, fucking have it on YouTube, you know, talk about these films, no matter if it's illegal or what. Like, no one is losing money.
Well, yeah, in this case, this is one of those cases that we say every time, you know, we talk about these. This is one of those cases where I think we have to go through...
Like, if no one downloaded it and no one shared it, the movie would die.
Yeah.
Because in order for more people to talk about it and request it from whatever company could release it, that's the only way people are going to talk about it.
Yep.
You know, is if it's shared. So, you know, it's one of those things where piracy does come into play for the better, you know, with films like this, is to get the word out and spread it that this movie is cool, that it needs to be seen, that it needs to be saved. So by all means, like, fucking watch this on YouTube, share it with your friends, and just, you know, tell everybody, request it for Vinegar Syndrome or fucking Code Red, and tell them to fucking pick it up and release it. Give it another life.
Yeah.
You know, because this is one of these films that could slowly die out and never be seen again.
Yep. Yeah, and the full movie's available on YouTube. I just confirmed it. So, I mean, we'll put a link in the show notes for sure. All right, gentlemen. So, it is getting late.
Yes.
So, I'm getting tired. You guys got to be way more tired than me because you're farther along in time zones. You're further ahead of me.
Thank you for bringing it up.
Yep. You're welcome. So, check out Etiquette Pictures, Vinegar Syndrome, and
Exploitation TV,
and I need to get out there more. They're still doing the. It's only on Roku, right?
Roku and just the mobile.
Yeah.
Mobile device, yeah. And I mean, okay. You could watch them on there. But yeah, Roku. It's a private channel, so you have to add that to your listing. It's just not going to come up. You have to add it as a private channel, mainly because of the pornography, and you can watch it on your TV. There have been reports of the movies failing to play sometimes, so it is a known issue, and I know they are working on it. It's like kind of off and on for some people. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Hmm. Okay.
So just keep that in mind.
Cool. Yeah, it's a lot of people discovering it and having fun with it. So it's cool seeing people discover it. All right, and Jacob, where can people find your writing?
Right now, I'm solely at Birth Movies Death.
Okay, very cool. So check out
that's it. Apparently,
Jacob Q. Nice. Check out his writings over there at Birth Movies. Is it birthmoviesdeath.com?
It is birthmoviesdeath.com.
Very nice. And everyone knows where to find me and Brad.
In hell.
In hell. Exactly. Fiercely masturbating to
70s porn. Fiercely masturbating to Tracy Lords.
I don't know. Not Tracy Lords. Yeah, I was always kind of a Shannon Tweed or Maria Ford guy.
Okay. I think this could be another article, Brad. I'm going to
assign Maria Ford movies. Let's talk about Maria Ford movies for a minute. So, but anyways. Yeah.
Awesome. All right, well, if you have a great week, check out our sponsors. Go to thescreamcast.com/sponsors and give them all some love. Coffee Shop of Horrors and Grindhouse Video, of course, check them out. And use the coupon codes if you order something for them. Check out the website, of course, thescreamcast.com. We're having more and more articles and lists posted per week, so check those out. And we hope to have more and more on there as more writers start jumping on board. And otherwise, all of you guys have a great week. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Bye-bye. Oh, don't tell me you're leaving. The party's just begun.
I'm introducing you as the Q.
Yeah, sure, why not? Yeah, you can call me whatever you want.
Dude, you can't make me laugh. We'll call.